listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Attica Locke's first novel, Blackwater Rising, was nominated for a 2010 Edgar Award, a 2010 NAACP Image Award, as well as a Los Angeles Times Book Prize, and was shortlisted for the Orange Prize in the United Kingdom. Attica's written movie and television scripts for Paramount, Warner Brothers, Disney, and other studios, and she was also a fellow at the Sundance Institute Feature Filmmakers Lab. Danzy Senna's debut novel, Caucasia, was the LA Times Book of the Year and became an instant national bestseller. Her second novel, Symptomatic, was published in 2003, and her latest work is the memoir, Where Did You Sleep Last Night? A Personal History, in which she reconstructs a long-buried family mystery. Both of these brilliant young writers are daughters of 1960s and 70s civil rights, black power, and feminist political movements. Attica Locke was born, as she writes, 3 years after the political moment in time for which I was named, the uprising at Attica Prison in upstate New York in 1971, and shortly after my parents had walked away for good from the political movement that had defined their very young lives. Her novel, Blackwater Rising, was inspired by an actual incident involving young Attica and her father, a former radical turned attorney. In Where Did You Sleep Last Night, Danzy Senna recounts her obsessive, almost desperate struggle to understand the forces that drove her parents. Her mother was the descendant of New England blue bloods, while her father was the son of a black woman and, depending on whom Senna asks, a Mexican boxer or an Irish priest, so violently apart. The result is a haunting, introspective meditation on race and family ties that tackles the tricky questions involved in constructing identity. Tonight we'll hear, as I say, a reading by both authors, and then they'll interview each other about the sources of their fiction and nonfiction and the political context of their parents' lives that in no small part frames their own creative work. Afterwards, they'll both be signing their books in the lobby. Please welcome Attica Locke and Danzy Senna. Thank you.
Very comfortable to sit down. First of all, thank you guys for coming. I appreciate it very much. So my first novel, Blackwater Rising, takes place in Houston, Texas in 1981. It is a murder mystery. It is a man's biography, and it's a piece of history. A lot of times when I do readings, I often read from the parts of the book that are historical or that are flashbacks within the book, because it kind of, you know, sets the tone of everything, and it also doesn't give any of the plot away. The gentleman at the center of this book is a man by the name of Jay Porter, who in 1981 is a small-time criminal defense attorney, again in Houston, Texas, who was heavily involved in the civil rights movement and now finds himself at the dawn of the Reagan era and is trying to emotionally navigate that. But part of what I'm going to read from tonight are pieces from his past. In the present, in the story, the mayor of Houston, Texas in 1981 is a white woman by the name of Cynthia Maddox. She's the first woman mayor of Houston, Texas, and she and Jay have a past. And this first bit that I'm going to read is when Jay and Cynthia first met. He doesn't remember when he stopped loving her. It would be neat and tidy to say his arrest, those frantic and confused days after he turned himself in, long hours spent in lockup trying to explain to his court-appointed lawyer what exactly had happened, trying to understand it himself. He doesn't remember when he stopped loving her or when exactly he started. They never called it anything or gave it a name. In the beginning, she was just a scruffy kid who started coming around to meetings. He was the one who had been appointed to tell her, as forcefully as need be, to stop. They didn't want her help. Her political awakening was on her own time, not theirs. Besides, in those days, the sisters were still frying chicken and going on beer runs for the meetings, walking 10 feet behind the men at campus marches. If the brothers hadn't run her off, the sisters surely would have. No way a white girl was going to get in line first. He went to tell her in person even though he didn't have to. He could have waited until she showed up at the next meeting at the duplex on Scott Street, where they spent most of their days organizing marches, skipping classes, eating whatever somebody's little paycheck could scrounge up. He could have waited and made a show of the whole thing, putting down the white girl in front of everybody, but he had no desire to be cruel. She took the news well. After calling him a racist and a chauvinist, a word he had to look up when he got home, she told him she thought he was the only one in his group who had any sense. She asked him if he wanted to join her for dinner, her treat. Jay, who had holes in his coat and was working on a few in the soles of his shoes, was quite grateful for the offer. They went to a barbecue stand on Telephone Road, her choice, and all through dinner she ran through a laundry list of things she'd been saving up, stuff she would have said at the meetings if they'd ever let her talk, how they could work the system from the inside, plant one of their own on the school's admin board, or even better, the city council. Infiltration, she said, chomping on an ice cube soaked in Big Red soda. The FBI ain't all crazy. She thought they could pull it off, too, but they would need somebody unassuming, somebody the establishment would never suspect. She licked the corners of her mouth and smiled, an indication that she knew such a person, maybe someone sitting across the table from him right now. You may need me more than you think you do. And she had more to say, too. She claimed their meetings were disorganized, too much eating and smoking and not enough focus. She also thought the Panthers were onto something with their uniform look. Have y'all ever thought about getting matching outfits, something jazzy like with rainbows on the back? By then, Jay had heard enough. He mumbled something about a paper he had to write, thanked her for the meal, and hitched a ride back on his own. He frankly didn't think he'd ever see her again, but Cynthia Maddox was insatiable and full of ideas. She was on a full scholarship and making straight A's. She had a lot of time on her hands. She stopped coming by the house on Scott Street and started calling him up at his dorm, on the hallway phone, all time of the night, wanting to run her ideas by him. She was a member of SNCC by then, a group she'd finally talked her way into, and was starting up one of the few SDS chapters in the state. She wanted to know what he thought about this or that. Would he look at a draft of a press release she was drafting, urging a boycott of the student union cafeteria? Could she get him to agree to give her a heads up about any marches he had planned so she could coordinate something with her groups? And what did he really think about nonviolence? I mean, really, don't you think we're past all that? Finally, one day, just to shut her up, he asked her where she was from, where she'd gone to high school. She grew up in Katy, she said, out west off the I-10 freeway. She'd come to college late, already in her 20s, and before that, she'd spent her entire life within a 15-mile radius. They got to be friends that way, talking about home. Turns out Cynthia didn't know her daddy either. She had a bastard stepfather, too, a guy not even 10 years older than she was, who used to look at her funny when she was coming out of the bathroom. It was weeks before Jay would tell her his story, the soft footsteps he used to hear in the dark, his stepfather padding past on the way to Jay's sister's room. He'd always hear his mother next, shuffling on the same worn carpet in the hallway, walking into her daughter's room to stop whatever had happened or was about to. Jay tried to tell his buddies once. He and Bumpy Williams and Lloyd McElvey were sharing a bottle of Jack on the front porch of Bumpy's mother's house in Third Ward, long after a card game had broken up. Jay tried to tell them about his family, what tore it up. But his friends weren't interested in personal tragedy. They were out to save a race of people. There was a war going on. This was no time for baby sisters and family squabbles. But Cynthia listened. She said it wasn't his fault. You should call her, she said, meaning his sister. Their phone calls started to stretch so long that some of the boys on his floor complained, and he and Cynthia took to meeting off campus, beer joints and taco stands, sometimes sneaking off to the movies, something he never did with Bumpy or Lloyd. And they hit every blues hall in Third Ward. Once they saw Lightnin' Hopkins play at the Pinup Club, Cynthia nearly fainted from the heat, the stench of sweat and perfume, and the shots of hooch she kept accepting from a group of sisters who were having a little fun with her, playing like they were her friends, laying out sly compliments about her stringy hair and laughing at her behind her back. Jay ended up having to drive her home. It was too late to try to sneak her into the girls' dorm, so he drove in circles around town, Cynthia laid out across his lap in the front seat of her green Ford truck. Near dawn, he settled into the parking lot of an old elementary school out in the Heights. It was Sunday morning by then, and no one was around. Cynthia came to around dawn. She sat up and looked out the window and asked where they were. Cynthia turned and looked at him, and he can still see her now. Her hair was messed up and tangled, and it was stringy. She had mascara smudged under both of her eyes. Still, she was beautiful, a fact that he finally allowed himself to admit. And she was, at that moment, probably the best friend he had. "I like you, Jay," she whispered. And he felt something flutter in his stomach. He was suddenly terribly aware of how hungry he was, how empty he'd been for years. "I like you," she said. There was no way he would make the first move. She seemed to know this without anything needing to be said. When she finally kissed him, the taste was big, meaty, and warm, and kind of bitter, like blood, and he couldn't restrain himself any longer. He put his hands everywhere. Before long, they moved to the bed of the truck, lying on top of Jay's ratty coat, his backbone pressed against the metal bed, as she, of course, insisted on being on top. There on his back, eyes stretched past the ponderosa pines to the starlit sky above, Jay held his breath. There were many other times, in the truck, in the basement of her dorm, and once on top of a picnic table after midnight in McGregor Park, one of the stupidest things he's ever done. He never told his friends, and she never told hers. It was just between the two of them. They met in silence most nights, reaching for each other like a salve, slick, wet kisses to wash away everything past the reach of their young arms. By the time the feds killed those boys in Chicago in the winter of 69, everyone was on the lookout for rats. The administration was cracking down. There were cops on campus, cops everywhere, it seemed. The FBI and local law enforcement had moved on to new strategies. They'd grown tired, it seemed, of billy clubs and water hoses. They were just flat-out shooting people now. What had started some 15 years earlier with peaceful sit-ins and boycotts had disintegrated into guerrilla warfare. Something ugly was happening around them. King was dead by then, Malcolm and two Kennedys. Death was everywhere. Cynthia asked him once about getting a gun. He feigned ignorance and told her to watch herself. He didn't want her getting hurt. SNCC was falling apart. Cynthia was spending more and more time trying to get attention for her fledgling SDS chapter, getting deeper and deeper into her own rhetoric, her ideas that they should meet fire with fire. She started speaking around campus more and more, standing on classroom chairs outside the admin building, screaming until her throat was raw, always quoting Malcolm as if the rest of them had never heard of him. She got her name in the school paper, but the Post and the Chronicle mostly ignored her, treating her as little more than a groupie, a white girl caught up in nigger fever, as sure as if the Temptations came to town. This next part is, this is actually based on a bit of a memory of my father and fiction. It's when Stokely Carmichael came to the University of Houston in 67, I want to say. This explains the lead-in to Jay's activism. Years earlier, Jay had stumbled on his first sit-in on the way to class and decided then and there he'd rather be a part of history than study that. And after that, there was no turning back. Once one dorm was integrated, they all had to be. Once one black professor was hired, there had to be a dozen more. He would settle for nothing less. Jay rode this initial wave of activism as a rank-and-file member of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which had a strong presence across the South. SNCC came out of the SCLC tradition, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, Dr. King's group through the 50s and 60s. It was a tradition steeped in the assumption that moralism is a real and potent weapon, or the presumption, rather, that you could shame white people into acting right. Well, that was one way of doing it. But it required a kept tongue and an unyielding faith in a higher power, something Jay did not have. Much as he would go on to preach on the limits of a spiritual approach to civil rights, much as he would chide the churchified for taking it laying down, he always deep down admired men like King, for whom the ability to love was a gift, like an ear for music. Jay, on the other hand, lived a life of constant struggle against his own cynicism, his well-earned knowledge of the limits of human grace. It was Jay Porter whom Stokely Carmichael, chairman of the national chapter of SNCC, called when he was coming through Texas for the first time. There was an anti-war rally happening in Austin that April, and Stokely wanted to speak in Houston while he was in the state. All through that winter and spring, he'd been traveling the country, speaking on campuses or wherever he could get a hall, reworking and refining a position paper he was calling Toward Black Liberation. The remarks, which Jay and his group had not heard, as no Houston paper would print them, were apparently so inflammatory that Carmichael was being blamed for riots all across the country. Texas Southern, just a few minutes from the U of H campus, flat out wouldn't have him. The University of Houston also said no, and Jay simply ignored them. The night Stokely came through town, Cullen Auditorium was free, so that's where they held the rally, just went in and took it over. Word got around campus, and some 300 people showed up, more than the hall could hold. They were spilling out into the hallway onto the grass lawn outside, some curious, wanting to be a part of the thing that everyone was talking about. But there was also a contingent of rebels, conservative white students who didn't want this loudmouth nigger on their campus, and they raised their painted signs and fists to make it known. And just beyond the doors in martial formation on the lawn were 100 officers from the police and sheriff's department dressed from head to toe in riot gear. It was after 9 by the time Stokely took the podium. The air in the hall was muggy, thick with the breathy heat of anticipation, everyone waiting and wondering just what was this brother going to say. Stokely came on stage dressed clean as a whistle, in a pressed suit and thin black tie, not a wrinkle on him. And he was wearing shades, black and wide, like Ray Charles, like a blues philosopher. Jay can still remember his first words. Stokely looked directly at the white rebels and said, "One of the most pointed illustrations of the need for black power in a society that has degenerated into a form of totalitarianism is to be found in the very debate itself." The white students in the audience, rebels and liberals alike, were struck dumb, silenced by the sheer force of words they didn't understand, their own language turned against them. Backstage, Jay felt his whole world was busting wide open. The term black power had only recently caught on and contributed to Stokely's militant reputation. But as he began to lay it down that night in Cullen Auditorium to lay out his case, it sounded less radical to Jay and more like good old common sense. It was frankly gospel. The black students waved their hands in the air, clapping and calling out to Brother Carmichael as if they were in church. The concept of integration is based on the assumption that there is not value in the Negro community. Mm-hmm, that's right. So they siphon off acceptable Negroes into the middle class. Preach on it, brother. And each year, a few more Negroes armed with their passports, their university degrees, escape into middle class America. Come on now, tell it. And one day the Harlems and the Wattses and the Fifth Wards will stand empty, a tribute to the success of integration. Right on, man. The crowd was clapping and stomping so loud that Jay could feel it backstage as if the walls were shaking. "So what you're preaching, man?" one of the white students down front asked, a cat dressed in cords and a denim patch jacket. "Isn't it just racism of a different color? Isn't black power inherently anti-white?" "Well, see, you're still putting yourself at the center of it, Jack. That's what you ain't getting yet. Black folks ain't," you guys are gonna make me laugh, "black folks ain't talking about you or to you no more." He had to be escorted out of the back entrance that night because not because of rioting, but because so many people wanted to shake his hand, wanted a word with the brother. Jay had to shuttle him out of the rear of the auditorium to avoid a mob. He shoved Stokely into Lloyd McElvey's VW Bug, and the three of them rode on to Austin that night. That was the first night somebody put a gun in Jay's hand. The Klan had threatened publicly to meet Mr. Carmichael on Highway 71 that night, stopping the car before it got past Bastrop. They promised a good show for anyone man enough to come out and watch. Lloyd kept a little .22 pistol under the front seat. He handed the gun to Jay and appointed him lookout. Stokely talked the whole way on the road that night, his head leaned against the passenger side window, coat turned around and tucked under his chin like a blanket. He was mumbling softly over the radio about how they were going to change the world, how it was going to be better for their kids. Jay remembers Aretha had a new cutout that spring, a haunting cover of Sam Cooke's A Change Is Gonna Come. The music was so slow and pretty that Lloyd turned up the radio and the three of them rode in silence in the car, smoking cigarettes and listening to Aretha sing of hope, Jay with Lloyd's pistol still in his hand. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming, and thank you for thinking of putting us together, Attica. It's an amazing book, and I'm very excited to talk about it. And I'm going to read from my memoir, which just came out in paperback this last spring, and it's my first foray into nonfiction. I think of myself first as a fiction writer and novelist. It's called Where Did You Sleep Last Night? And It began, my mother is one of the, is a descendant of one of the largest slave trading families in the Northeast Corridor, actually the largest, the DeWolf family. And she comes from Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I was living there as an adult about 7 years ago and standing on a street corner, and I had never really noticed anything about her family history growing up because she was sort of a lefty radical growing up and kind of chose a different path for her life. And I was had just moved back to Massachusetts for the first time since high school, and I was standing on a street corner in Cambridge, and I looked around and I saw her family name in about five different variations on street signs, realtor signs, subway maps, and it kind of hit me, the privilege and the compulsively documented nature of my mother's family history. And what interested me was the other side of my family. It reminded me of the absence of what was not written. My African-American father comes from the Deep South, comes from Alabama and Louisiana, and I realized I literally knew almost nothing about his family history. And so the book began at that moment, this question into where did his people come from? Where did he come from? And in many ways, it was a fraught journey because my father and I have a very fraught relationship, and he's a very difficult, he was a difficult father for me growing up. And so I tried to keep it a sort of stark, a stark family history as I was writing it, but the memoir kept creeping in, and I realized that I couldn't tell the history without telling my personal history at the same time. So the book kind of goes in between these narratives of my search for my my father's history, and also my kind of finally, after writing fiction for a very long time, looking directly at the story that I had sort of been afraid to look at, which was the story of my father and I and our relationship. And the quote at the beginning of the book is by Zora Neale Hurston. It's, "A thing is mighty big when time and distance cannot shrink it." I'm just going to read a few passages. "There is always that moment, fragile, brief, when I see my father coming toward me from a distance and I am happy, particularly in odd places far from home, like the time he came to visit me at the artist colony in New Hampshire. I had been there a few weeks already and had bonded with the other colonists, so it felt odd, a little bit intrusive, to have a person from my outside life come visit. But when my father called and asked if he could pop in one afternoon, it was only a few hours' drive from Rhode Island where he lived, I felt a wave of homesickness and agreed to see him. I remember sitting and waiting for him in the common room in front of the big picture window, surrounded by a crowd of other colonists. It was midday, prime work time, but as I sat there waiting, and my father was late, very late, people trickled in one by one until a small crowd had formed around me. 'I hear you're waiting for your father,' more than one remarked as they settled onto the couch beside me. And it struck me at some point that they were waiting to see my father too. It was curious to me that they would want to meet him. I wondered why they would not prefer to be working in their cabins the way they had come here to do. As I watched the snow fall slowly outside the window, a thought crept into my mind. I wondered if they were gathered around me out of that old racial curiosity. I thought perhaps they wanted to see if it was true, if somebody who looked so like one of them could really have a black father. It was that old fault line again, and I felt alien from the colonists whom I'd grown to feel were my friends over the past weeks. I felt what I'd felt so many times in my life, that I was a specimen. And I wanted them all to go away so I could wait for my father in private. Then I saw his blue pickup truck pull up in the driveway outside, and I said, rising, 'That's him. He's here.' The group around me became quiet, and they all stared out the picture window as he stepped out of his truck in a trench coat, a hat on his head, and made his way across the gravel to the farmhouse where we waited. I saw him through their eyes, and I felt a surge of pride as I watched him walking through the snow, pride that he was my father. My father is handsome, on his good days, even now, When he has not been drinking too much, he is strikingly handsome. A hush fell over the group as they watched him approach. He came through the door, and I felt the eyes of the others on us as I rose to greet him. I hugged him, hello, and I remember I made a show of being more affectionate toward him than I would have been if we were unobserved. I felt the need to perform our closeness. In that embrace, I wanted to show that I was with him, not them. No matter how friendly I'd been toward them the past few weeks, they did not know the real me. After the embrace, I turned around and introduced him to them, and for a moment, everything was perfect. He had not revealed himself. He was just a mysterious, handsome black man in snappy clothes, a mystery man, the paper doll hero out of a Sidney Poitier movie, who had shown up in New Hampshire to visit his writer daughter. And if I could freeze it there, in that moment of him nodding his head hello, he would be the perfect father, the father of my childhood daydreams. That was what he was to the crowd of white faces who stared at us. I imagined I had gone from being just one of the other colonists to being something far more interesting because of this man by my side. After they'd all said hello, I shuttled him out the door, saying I wanted to show him my studio. I needed us to disappear quickly before he could do anything to ruin the picture. Today, in an effort to describe him, I sat down and wrote a list of words, rumors, impressions, lies, truths that I associate with him. Intellectual, alcoholic, wanderer, race man, con artist, member briefly of the Communist Party, capitalist, exile, chameleon, a walking, talking contradiction. Growing up, I could never keep track of which group in the population he mistrusted the most. Whenever I would complain to him about somebody doing something wrong to me, a teacher in school who'd given me a bad grade, a rude sales clerk, he would respond, "What was their last name?" It didn't matter what answer I gave him. Their last name could be anything, Polish, German, Indian, Spanish, Asian, Irish. His response would be the same, a cynical smirk, a shake of the head as if to say, "Well, what did you expect from one of them?" He rarely dated black women, but when I walked through Boston with him, he would give the solidarity nod to every black man we passed on the street. For a long time, I thought he was a personal friend of every black man in Boston. His best friend for a time was a paraplegic white lawyer. We would drive around Boston, the three of us kids crammed in the back with a folded wheelchair, while my father and Shankman, as my father called him, sat in the front trading get-rich-quick schemes. I used to daydream about a fantasy father, a cleaned-up version of my own, a father who wore a suit, made money, and didn't get drunk and lose control, and who looked just like Billy Dee Williams in the 70s classic Mahogany. My real father was just as handsome but much less smooth, and he seemed to have sprung from nowhere. His mother had died by the time I was three, and his siblings had fled the city. The other characters from his youth were still in the deep South, a place I'd never been. All I had were scraps of information. I knew he had spent his youth in Alabama and Louisiana. Then, when he was 10, his mother moved north with him and his siblings and settled in Boston's Cabot Street housing projects. There, he excelled in his studies and became one of the first cluster of black students to go to Boston University. He married my mother, blue eyes, blue blood. In 1968, only a year after Loving versus State of Virginia, the Supreme Court case that overturned the laws banning interracial marriage, and only 6 months after the assassination of Martin Luther King. By the time my father was 28, he was the youngest editor at Beacon Press, author of The Fallacy of IQ, a seminal book on standardized testing and race, a published poet and short story writer. He was, in other words, a Negro of exceptional promise. That dangerous phrase, exceptional promise, swirled around him as it has swirled around me, like a jinx or a dare. By the age of 30, my father had lost everything that mattered to him. Gone was the Negro of exceptional promise. And in its stead, he lived up to all the stereotypes that his fellow Americans had ever secretly or not so secretly harbored about black men. He could not consistently stay sober. He got fired from his job, and after my mother left him, he followed her one night to a friend's dinner party and in front of all the guests, dragged her down the steps by her hair and beat her in the street. Recently, I came across an article from the Boston Sunday Globe for October 13, 1969, entitled "A Dropout Rejoins the Family of Writers." It is a profile of my mother. At the time, she was only a year into her marriage to my father and had just given birth to her first child and had recently published her first book, a collection called 40 Wax, named after that old Lizzie Borden playground rhyme. The Globe article written by Ellen Goodman portrays my mother as a rebel who has rejected her aristocratic roots, indeed has taken that figurative axe to her patrician heritage. She writes of my mother, "She is the slight and feminine descendant, if not heir, of the Howe family, an impressive lineage of scholars, authors, and thoroughly eminent Bostonians." The article says she is married to, quote, black writer Carl Senna, who teaches English and African literature at Tufts University and is an editor at Beacon Press. The piece is accompanied by a large photograph of my mother holding my four-month-old sister. At the time of the article, my parents lived outside the city in a town called Marblehead, a protected harbor in Salem Bay, in a house overlooking the Atlantic Ocean. Goodman describes my mother standing at the kitchen of that oceanside home, unscrewing the top of a jar of peas for her baby daughter, who, quote, kicked her feet impatiently and let out bleeps of hunger sounds. Every detail signifies domestic coziness, the pedestrian normality only underscoring the young family's literary and multiracial exoticism. It is strange, disconcerting even, for me to read the 1969 profile of my mother after all that has occurred, to hear Goodman's romantic portrayal of my parents' life together. Even the few mildly complaining details that my mother offers up about my father in the article serve to cast a more romantic light on their union. "It is hard being married to a writer," my mother is quoted saying. "We both experience the same things, and it's a question of who will write about them first. But the main thing is finding separate places to write in the house." These are glittery, hopeful people, an interracial couple out of a dream. Today, I live in Southern California, where these histories, both my mother's and my father's, make no sense. New money, new malls, new races, they crop up every day in this land of perpetual amnesia. I am 9 months pregnant. I have left behind my first family, and am on my way to creating my second, chosen family. And so, in a sense, I am free of all of this history. My husband and I live in a fancy, brand-new apartment building where television studios house actors and talent show contestants each year. Wannabe movie stars pass me in the hall on my way to the trash chute. My husband and I have noticed there are a large number of attractive interracial couples and their café au lait progeny living in the building. We had not sought out racial comfort when we were looking for a place to live, just ease and sunlight and high ceilings and a neighborhood where we could walk. But what we've stumbled on is something I could not have imagined existed growing up in the rigidly stratified world of Boston. What we have now is multicultural to the point of absurdity. The week we moved in, our neighbors from down the hall, a white fashion model and her television personality husband, a first-generation Nigerian-American, left us a gift on our doorstep, a pair of tiny baby-sized fur boots in preparation for our baby's arrival. The Indian woman in the lobby gave me the name of her pediatrician. The very trim and pretty building manager, a black woman named Lane, mentioned a Mexican nanny she could recommend. There's so much approval and friendly anticipation of our baby before he is even born that I began to fantasize that it was a secret cult like the one in the apartment building in Rosemary's Baby. Except that this group is based not on devil worship, but on miscegenation worship. It strikes me that my husband and I are only passing as an interracial couple. I wonder if these same people will be disappointed when they find out, if they find out, that we are in actuality something far more old-fashioned, a red-boned black man with a high yellow woman, that our backgrounds are embarrassingly similar, a swirl of slave masters and slaves. Outside the window of my office, where I sit writing about the tangled past, are palm trees and cars zipping past on Rossmore Avenue. And across the street is the Country Club Manor, an elegant old building where a famous comedian is rumored to keep his pied-à-terre. Farther down the block is the Mauritania, an Art Deco building commissioned by Jack Haley, the actor who played the Tin Man in The Wizard of Oz. Two doors down sits the Ravenswood, a building Mae West lived in until her death. I suppose it is no coincidence that it is here I have chosen to give birth, so far from Boston and my history, far from my parents' saga of the Deep South and the Deep North. Here, in the pale light of my chosen amnesia, I can imagine I am free. Thank you.
Find my notes. I'm going to start. Okay. Well, so the theme of our talk tonight, Ms. Danzy Senna, is navigating history. So you and I are both writers who are pulling material from history that is either personal or political or both. So when you're in your work and when you're conceiving your work, where do you feel that your responsibilities lie? Do they lie with the history itself or with the narrative and the a good story, so to speak?
Well, it's different with fiction and nonfiction, and it's interesting because both of us have worked in at least two different genres. You've worked in film and now in book fiction. And I've really only written fiction, and then I did this crazy thing of writing about my family, which I don't recommend anyone doing. And I think there were some of the same issues came up of narrative and of trying to tell a very good, compelling story, trying to, as do in fiction, in writing this book, trying to create a complex character out of my father and all the other people in the book. But it's a remembered history, so it's very subjective, the story I'm trying to tell here. And if you ask my siblings, they would describe a different father and they would describe a different childhood.
That's a question I thought when you were reading. Did you, in terms of sparking your memory or going, did you ask their perspective on things as you were writing or as you were preparing the material?
Once I did. I asked my brother, but it was just a very specific detail about where were we standing. But for the most part, I decided not to put this on them. They weren't responsible for my memories, and I wasn't responsible for theirs. And everybody was nervous about the book in the family anyway, and so they didn't really want to talk to me about it. But I basically decided, you know, that this is my truth that I'm trying to tell. This is what I remembered. And I had to be truthful to my memory at all times. And I had to check certain facts, you know, that were actual things you could check. But for the most part, it was taking a bunch of research and then taking my memories and trying to string them together into a compelling narrative. And so some of the same problems existed, but in the end, whatever I write, it's the story first. I mean,
how did they know you were doing it? Like, why did you even share with them that you were,
I know.
I mean,
at first it was going to be just this stark sort of family history, trying to discover more about especially my African-American grandmother. But as I dug deeper, and my father kept giving me information about his childhood, but he kept saying, you know, you are going to stop this book at 1970 when you're born, right? It was like, the history ends there, right? And I was like, I'm not sure yet. Let me see. And so, you know, once he had opened that door to his family history, he wanted to control where that narrative went. And for me, you know, it was really important that I follow where the narrative was going. And there was no way to tell this story of my father's family history without talking about why. Why did I want to know where he was from? Because I needed to understand this person who had a profound influence, both good and bad, on my life.
Right.
And so, you know, you have to be kind of ruthless, I think, if you're a writer. You have to be kind of, first and foremost, you have to be interested in the truth. And that can be very scary, and it can piss a lot of people off, whether you're writing fiction or nonfiction.
Yes, yeah. Do you feel like the ruthlessness is still something that you have to work at, or is it now become second nature, the idea of being able to put aside other people's concerns or get other people's voices out of your head? Has it gotten easier, or do you think it's as hard
It'll always be something I negotiate. And there's a lot in this book that I didn't put in because of people not wanting people to have their business out there. I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff that I didn't put in there. It was just a personal call on what I felt I was comfortable telling. And, you know, it couldn't be motivated by a desire to hurt or by childhood anger. It really had to be motivated by curiosity about this story, and actually an attempt to understand my father, not reveal or expose him, but to understand him. But ultimately, you know, a friend of mine, when I was about to publish the memoir, I said, oh my God, my family is going to kill me when this book comes out. And she said, well, welcome to the family of writers, because that's all you may have left at the end of the story.
Well, I have heard people say that if you don't piss somebody off, you're probably not doing it very well.
And if it doesn't, I think for me with writing fiction and nonfiction, that everything I've written has terrified me. And that's a good sign, usually, if I'm terrified by what I'm writing in some way.
Take that home tonight, because I'm terrified right now. So I found that when I read this book, Where Did You Sleep Last Night, that it expanded my understanding of your other work, because I just don't know how it's not possible that if you learn about an author's history, psyche, this, that, and the other, it was almost as if this book and Caucasia were talking to each other in a way. Is that something that's planned, conscious, unconscious? Is the idea that each work stands on its own, or do you mean the body of work to start to take on a larger, its own narrative arc in a way?
Yeah, I think that the body of work is always going to be, once you write, you know, several books, those can't help but speak to each other, but you don't really have control over what they're saying to each other. And for me, you know, I had written two books that were very much about race and identity, and the sort of parents kind of loomed large in the movement, and their politics loomed large. And I had the sense that if I did not look at the truth of what had happened, I would keep writing the same book forever. And there was a way I wanted to put closure to a certain story. And so this was in a way kind of closure for me on a certain kind of material that I had been really struggling with for a decade. The demons of the movement, which you get into, and the children of that movement, and all of the politics of race and identity, which isn't to say I won't always write about that, but I felt like there was a certain way I would have to keep writing about it if I didn't talk about what had actually occurred. And with my first novel, you know, I went on this long book tour, and what depressed me most was that people read that book as a memoir, and that people thought Caucasia was my story. And what I was most proud of was that it wasn't mine, that I had created a work of
fiction. So a
private
pride, then, I guess, because everybody else didn't realize it.
And I think, you know, also knowing that there was this huge gap between that story, that was a complete fantasy, and then what was truthful and what I didn't want to look at and was terrifying to me was the really hard stuff that's in this book. And so I think that I needed to kind of close that circle in some way with this book.
Well, you and I have talked about what it is to be the child of a political movement and to challenge some of the romance about a movement.
That was one of my questions for you.
what that's like. And I hear in what you're saying that might be part of this closing of a circle.
Yeah. I mean, I'm always suspicious of mythologies, whether they be national mythologies, racial mythologies, feminist mythologies. All of these mythologies are dangerous, whatever form they take. And I think it is, in some ways, our job as writers to deconstruct those.
Yeah.
And that leads me to...
I'm going to ask you one last question. This is a short one. You say there's this really, really funny story in your book about trying to get the free camera.
Yes.
And you pretend to be your father's child bride from Puerto Rico so that you guys could go talk to the timeshare lady and get a free camera. And you open the chapter with that there's a true story about my father and me that I've been trying to turn into fiction for years. So how do you make decisions where something lies in fiction and where something lies in memoir?
I feel like it's hard to systematically make that decision. I mean, there's pieces of, in say, like, Caucasia, there are pieces of my real father in that father, and there are pieces of me in that father.
Yeah.
It's never like you're just representing somebody you know. As you know, it's often, once you turn somebody into fiction, it's free, you know, it's up for grabs. You can take qualities of everything.
A lot of people don't understand
that. So, I mean, the book Caucasia, you know, the dad is me, the sister is me, the mom is me.
It's kind of like a dream, and they say in dream analysis that everybody in your dream is really you. Maybe every character in our books is not you, I think, at the same time.
It's that paradox. So, for me, it's really about letting that kind of subconscious take over in fiction. And in this, it was about, you know, looking at things I was terrified to look at and creating a kind of montage and hoping that these things in conjunction would have a kind of meaning and energy.
It was kind of quilt-like.
Quilt-like, yeah.
Which I thought fit, like, the travel to the South. I don't know, something about it kind of fit.
Yeah. So I was curious in reading your book about many things, but, I mean, there are so many, and I read your statement, this sort of personal essay you wrote about the origins of the book, and you know, it's funny when you start to feel like a type, because you and I, what year were you born?
74.
Yeah, I'm old. I'm 70. But we both, you know, had this kind of parents who had this past that we didn't really live firsthand,
but
hovered over us and affected our consciousness anyway as we were growing up. And we were living the consequences of it, and we were the foot soldiers of the sort of idea of integration going out to wage their battle in the next stage.
Yep.
And so what I was really interested in that you chose to write a novel from your parents' generation's perspective. And I guess he's from your father's generation, this character.
Yeah, I mean, they probably are.
Or in between.
Would have been at the same age at in 1981. But, you know, the more I started to write the book, the more Jay is actually me.
Mm-hmm.
And is his experience is more a comment for me on what it felt like to be the first person in my family, my sister and I, first generation to live a fully integrated existence.
Hmm.
I have always said that the supreme irony, one of the supreme ironies of my life is that for all of the things that my parents, grandparents were fighting for and marching for, they were all things that they could not emotionally prepare me for. So that they never went to integrated schools. They never did that. So how do you tell a 5-year-old the first day they're going to an all-white kindergarten what that's going to feel like? And they didn't really know how to prepare me. And so a lot of Jay's racial paranoia is actually my own, of what it is to have, you know, been a child when a country's in transition.
Mm-hmm.
And where the very fact that you're in a mixed school or in a mixed environment speaks to the progress, and yet my own personal experience wasn't always progressive.
Right.
It was sometimes very, very hurtful.
Right. And, yeah, you have this wonderful line about Jay. You say at one point he has his own racialized disposition, his sensitive, almost exquisite sense of the world as black and white. And that really spoke to me as somebody who was raised by parents who were completely obsessed by race. And it was like there wasn't a day that went by that it wasn't something we talked about in our family, and it didn't come up at the dinner table. And I was wondering, you know, about your relationship to that description and whether it reflected
it's twofold. From a psychological point of view, it again is that part of me that grew up being a little kid in a mixed school, scanning to figure out where I was safe.
Mm.
Who was it safe to talk to? Because you would befriend somebody and then you would find out all kind of crazy stuff about them, their parents. And then, you know, you just felt blindsided. And people, you know, kids are cruel and they turn on you. But there's also from a pragmatic point of view in writing a thriller that those blinders help to serve the story.
Mm.
Part of why Jay gets into the trouble that he gets in is because he literally cannot see clearly. That he has so been, he has so bought into the description of what it means to be a black man in America at this point in time, that he can't see outside of that box. So when he the first chapter of the book, he saves this woman on a boat, instead of going to the police and say, I think something's up, I heard gunshots. He's so caught in this box of black and white and race and danger and this, that he just keeps his mouth shut, and that gets him in bigger trouble. So it also had this kind of, there's a way in which it serves the genre.
And I loved that about the book, that you took all of this sort of conceits of the genre and then used sort of history and race and psychology and all these really complex sort of literary elements to kind of, it was amazing how seamlessly they worked for the plot.
Much.
I mean, it was just it's an amazing book.
That part, to be honest with you, it was a surprise. This is a much better book than the one I thought I was going to write. I really thought that I was...
Nice. No, usually the other way around.
I thought that I was just writing like a slick thriller. Mm-hmm. And I guess unconsciously I was doing certain things. It was 1981. He had been in the movement. I mean, I put these things in place. But what happened is there's also a longshoreman strike in the book. And Jay is being asked by some people to get involved because he knows the mayor. And I had to write the scene where Jay and the mayor see each other for the first time in 10 years. And I knew there was some kind of history, but I didn't really know. And I thought, well, I can't really write that scene unless I know what's their history. So the chapter I read tonight, I just wrote thinking I'm just doing this so I can write this other scene that really belongs in the book, because that one clearly didn't. But then when it came out, I kind of felt like, oh,
stumbled
that,
on
yeah,
this.
Like this actually might be the book, and then that kind of scared me a lot because it didn't fit. It didn't fit my understanding of what a genre could do, should do. I was very scared that I couldn't get away with it, that I couldn't have a kind of slick Grishamy, but I mean, it's not, you know, not quite Grishamy, but that it could have that kind of a plot, but then also be this other thing. I was really scared that I couldn't do it.
I mean, what's great about it is you sort of trick someone who might not be interested in the subject of history, black power, you know, race in America. You kind of, it's such an entertaining and gripping read that you would sort of trick them into
reading
all that.
That is the master plan.
Yeah.
No, and I think there's a way in which that's one of the genre's gifts. And I was just rewatching, people who are Facebook friends with me know this, rewatching the movie A Soldier Story, the Norman Jewison film from 1984. And it is exactly everything I kind of aspire to be. That it is on its face, some sergeant got murdered and somebody comes down to ask a bunch of questions, but it is set against the backdrop of the Nazis and eugenics and racial superiority, and all of that stuff is going on. And I kind of love that there could be a marriage of slick plot and deep feeling.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a pleasure to read, and it doesn't feel heavy-handed. And I think in some ways your film history must have played into your ability to pull that off, because not everybody can pull that off.
And it took me a long time because I have... not bitter feelings about Hollywood, but bitter feelings about Hollywood. So it took me a long time to deeply appreciate what I got out of screenwriting.
Yeah.
It took me a long time to see it that way. Instead of looking at, I mean, I was a screenwriter for 10 years and not one movie got made. Not one movie. But now that I look back on it, you know, Malcolm Gladwell always talks about the 10,000 hours. Maybe that was my 10,000 hours. I'll take it. I mean, I guess it's... maybe that's not so bad.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it has helped me a lot. And it took me a long time to stop apologizing for being a screenwriter.
Mm.
That took a really long time. I thought that I was told people would look down on me. And then I thought people would look down on me. And it took me a while to not apologize for my my life experience. It is what it is.
Yeah.
We should start thinking about taking questions.
Yeah, and open it up to the audience. Right here in the front.
Y'all bad. Yeah. And you're the same age as my daughter, 1970 baby.
Wow.
All right. Two questions, maybe. Second question is, how long y'all actually known each other? But don't answer that now. In your reading, the Stokely segment that you described, was that, I think you've mentioned that was your father's memory, or was that, how did that come about?
I just knew the facts of the year Stokely came through, why he was there, why my dad was the one who put it together. And when Jay says, I can still remember exactly what he said, that's what my dad said to me. I can still remember exactly Stokely's first lines. And the rest was kind of made up. Okay. The rest was kind of just made up. And having, you know, read a lot of things about Stokely, you know, knew the kind of stuff that he would say.
And the other question, I noted that there was this little line where you alluded to the assassination of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just curious, what is it that motivated you to
There's
put
another
that in?
Chapter in the book that, again, it speaks also to the genre in a way, because Jay is really paranoid. And part of his paranoia is coming from, he grew up at a time where to publicly speak out about your country meant you might get shot. And so there's this whole section in the book that explains, you know, how COINTELPRO came about. And so kind of just explain his constant agitation, so that this woman that he saves in the water, he gets a little like, well, who is this? And where did she come from? Because back in the day, somebody might plant somebody in your life to set you up. So that's, he's just paranoid.
I haven't been there. And we haven't known each other very long.
No, not very long.
No. Oh, you right there?
I'm curious. You've been very, very focused on your father in this evening. Is it because you feel you know everything about your mother? Because I find your mother's story fascinating, to have come from that family and to end up, you know, a left-wing radical. Is it because you had a better relationship with your mother? I mean, what's the percentage of both in the book? And
it's a book about my father, and you know, I really do believe that when you write a memoir, part of the art of it is knowing what to leave out, because you have infinite memories of your own life, and you really, to write a compelling narrative, you have to choose what the focus is. And for me, I say very early on that what interested me was what was missing from this story. And the tension between my father and I is the energy behind the book. My mother and I are very close, and we have a, you know, fairly functional relationship as far as mothers and daughters go. And we, you know, we're very friends, actually, but in a complicated mother-daughter way. But for me, what was interesting was this relationship to my father and the sort of narrative around his family history. And I felt that I couldn't tell all of these narratives at once. There were many interesting elements to the family history, but I wanted to really give energy, lightness, speed to the narrative. And so I had to choose what...
I felt like I got a sense of your mom, though.
But she's in here, and a bit of her history is in here, certainly, but... it just wasn't the question that was driving the narrative.
What was his reaction
to the book?
I was scared to ask that.
with reason. He's not happy with the book. I'll leave it at that.
Mm. There was a lady down here also.
Yeah, the one here in the...
Yeah, her, and then...
Hello. My question is actually to the both of you. When you're writing about a true event, which I write as well, and I'm trying to cover some true things, and some things can be really painful to approach, do you find it easier, especially in these works, to maybe fictionalize to some extent those parts to get beyond that process in the writing?
To get beyond the pain of it?
Right. Or not even the pain of it, but maybe a difficult or complex, you know, subject area.
Well, I mean, I'm prone to fictionalize everything. So, you know, to me, I just feel very comfortable. I said to my sister after I read your book that I just felt, like, paralyzed, because it's just scary. I mean, in that way, I like... to tell a truth a different way that's coded and covered. And I think I'm really scared to, I mean, I think, you know, everybody thinks that Jay is my father, and he's kind of like him in a way, but not him. But if I actually wrote a book, I think I would be really scared to do that. So I kind of make everything up, but that being said, and I don't know that there's a way around the pain part of it or the difficult part of it. In fact, if you're feeling that, I would probably say go forward into it, mm-hmm. is probably what I would say.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely much more viscerally terrifying to write about the living and the real. But there were other things that terrified me about the fiction. And you know, I had a moment, I had many moments before this book came out where I was just panicked. This book, you know, can I publish this book? Can I really tell this story? And why did I need to write this stuff? I shouldn't have written this down. And it's like, I think often children of alcoholics have that shame of just stating something factual, that your parent was drunk on this occasion. You're taught very early on to lie and cover them. And I said to my husband, you know, why did I need to write this at 3 in the morning, many waking him up 3 in the morning, why did I write this book? And, you know, and I said, it takes too many risks. I'm afraid of publishing it. It's too risky. And he kept reminding me that, A, I didn't write it by accident. I spent years on this book, so it was a conscious choice, and I need to own that. Like, I didn't just, whoops, I wrote a memoir. And... and I crafted it painstakingly. Like, this was something I chose to do, and I needed to recognize that. But also that in that knowledge was the knowledge that there was a risk in me not telling this story, mm-hmm. a huge risk. And I have 2 sons and young, you know, black boys being raised in this country, and my children, the children of this narrative. And I felt like at some level I owed it to them to examine the past and not put that onto them, that buried history, bring that once again into one more generation in my family, these things unsaid. But I had to know that there was love and compassion and curiosity driving it, mm-hmm. not, and knowing your intentions, I think, helps a lot.
Well, I just want to add to that. You know, I have 2 younger brothers here, who are from my dad's second marriage. So if when my sister and I came along, he wasn't talking about the movement. By the time they came along, he really wasn't talking about it. And so even my brother, when he read it, was like, wait, what? Like, where did this come from? Because my dad just doesn't say any of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, just to add to this idea of the importance of writing everything down.
You mentioned the fact that you felt like you were under a microscope at times in your life. Did that particular element maybe compel you to search this story up about your father and the history and identity? Because being a light bright myself, mm-hmm. my story is actually about my family history as well. And that, for me, is an element in my writing.
Well, I think I'm interested in the messy truth of race and letting it be as complex as it really is. I remember when I first published Caucasia, the New York Times Sunday Book Review did their review of it, and I don't know how many people have read it, but it's about 2 sisters who one of them is seen as white and the other is seen as black just based on their physical characteristics, but their parents are a black man and a white woman, and the whole enterprise in a way is to talk about race and identity in a complex way. And the New York Times published a review, and I don't remember what the heading was, but the subheading was, 2 sisters, one white and one black, are separated. And the whole review was like, Birdie, who is white, and Cole, who is black. And it was like, whoa, did they read the book? This is completely insane. So, you know, for me, like, just telling this really complicated story is part of letting that history be the mess and complexity that it is, yeah.
Thank you both so very much for the enlightening experience of you talk about your work. I've not read either book, though I've taught Caucasia. I was impressed with your treatment of Stokely Carmichael, Well, I would say the same thing about the one thing he didn't say is that he never had a piece of paper in front of him. Mm-hmm. He never read a single note. It was just all. It was that's so impressive.
Actually, that's actually a detail I didn't even know.
It's so impressive.
Even know that. Yeah.
And that's why you never forget it.
Yeah.
It's not a written text. But my question is to both of you, and it might be related to craft. It might be related to genre. You both make claims to be speaking the truth. That I think, Dancy, you said that this work had to be fact, the truth. But yet still, you almost immediately say, but there were things that I had to omit. Mm-hmm. So now that throws a cog, you know, in the machine for me, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
That you're telling the truth, mm-hmm. but you're choosing. You're making a very subjective choice. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not even a writer. This guy two doors over from me writes and does movies and all that kind of stuff. So maybe. But then you complicated it even further when you said Caucasia is not your story. And yet there are so many resonances, right?
Yeah.
And so it has to be truth in fact or fiction. I want her to comment on that. And then the last thing is, and you responded to this question, because I finally want to say now that you had to tell your father's story because you omitted it in Caucasia. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's my question. You know, how do you deal with all three of those things that seem to matter when you're telling the truth?
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of writers struggle with depression and anxiety. And no, let me finish what I was going to say. And I think that you know, one could think that writing causes those things, which it can. But I think that you write in a way to survive. And so for me, it was about survival, kind of just keep going to tell these stories in whatever form they took. But one of the things that's become really clear to me in publishing this book is that it's kind of about my father, but it's not really about my father, this book. And I had this amazing experience where I did a reading at Esawen Books, and it was a small audience, and there was a black man in the audience about my father's age. And I was really racked at this point with, you know, horror that my father was so upset about this book. And one of the things I talk about in this book is that I discovered in writing this is like with your siblings, like my dad had never told me that he grew up in an orphanage. And it was, you know, such a harrowing story. My father was placed in an orphanage from the ages of 5 to 8 of abusive Polish and Irish nuns. And they were all black children in an orphanage in Alabama being beaten and, you know, really very severely abused by these nuns and priests. And that's part of the story of uncovering this suffering. And he was very upset with the book because I told other things about my childhood in this book. And I was really upset about this. And I gave this reading at Esawen, and I kept thinking, why did I write this book about my dad? I shouldn't have said this stuff. And this man in the audience is listening very carefully to my reading, and he raises his hand afterwards, and he says, you know, I read your book, and I read this section where your father says about this Zimmer Home orphanage, that's where I got so fucked up. I quote my father as saying that. And the man said, I just wanted to thank you for writing this book, because I was in the Zimmer Home orphanage, and that's where I got so fucked up. And he said, your father, you know, he said, there's a whole generation of black boys and girls who experienced this, and I wanted to thank you for telling that. And for me, it was like, oh, this is actually bigger than my family.
You know, but what you're saying about what is truth and what, you know, the thing that's interesting about your book is that the other story that's being told is about ways in which truth is easily obfuscated by things not being written down.
Mm-hmm.
So that there's really another story that's going on about print.
Yeah.
And about your mother's family Privilege. So completely documented, but that you can move stuff around. One minute your dad has an Irish father, then he has a Mexican boxer father. When things aren't written down or records are just kind of, you know, fudged over, there's this other story that's speaking to your larger question about what truth is.
And because, also who feels the sort of the right to write their work,
right,
you know, because this man and my father, this man in the audience came and he showed me the sort of scattered pages of – things he had tried to write about mm-hmm. this experience mm-hmm. over his lifetime and had not completed. And it was like my father has been trying to write his story for his whole life and has not completed it. And that's what trauma does to you, you know, and mm-hmm. and also being taught that you don't, your story doesn't have value and isn't part of the essential narrative of American history.
It was also really interesting that a lot, and I hate to say black characters in the book because they're people, how much, and I guess I see it culturally in my family too, where you just kind of take what everybody's agreed is the truth and we're going to stop there.
Yeah.
That's kind of the end of it. And it you know, you can see where you layer that on top of an oral tradition on top where some stuff gets really lost yeah. that way.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Definitely.
One more question over here.
I'm sort of tripping off the last conversation because that was so deep and just wonderful. I have like a two-part question. One was it just seems in hearing you all talk and in actually hearing you all read excerpts from your book that these are cathartic experiences. And I just want to know if you could sort of share a little bit more about that. And then also, I'm sitting here thinking, wow, these are two women of children of black, female girls of black men. And there seems to be some sort of slightly romantic, nostalgic kind of connection to these stories of black fathers, even though I know yours is much more sort of intentional than yours because it's fictional and it's a thriller. So I'm just sort of somehow compelled by that and want to know if you can share a little bit more.
I can, and for me, the questions are connected even because I definitely feel like I wrote this book to understand the people who raised me. When I was younger, and I would look at pictures of my parents at marches, on courthouse steps, in the newspaper, I thought that they were heroes. It's now coming on to closer to 40 that I look at them and say, they were children. Oh, my God. I so was not doing that at 19. I wasn't doing any of that stuff. So to look back at it, so I say that to say that I think there was a part of me wanting to take down the romance in a way, or to understand that with the romance also came psychological damage. You know, I've always just felt that the people who were involved in the movement were almost like soldiers who were not treated as such. So that even though they had PTSD, nobody, there's no parade, there's no thing for that. So I grew up around people who were a little quiet, damaged, and I think I just wanted to really understand what it must have felt like to have done all this really heady political stuff at 19 and then start your middle class family. Like, what was that? And it was very cathartic for me. You know what was cathartic for me? When I first started this book, and I don't know, for people who have read it, my first idea of the book was that it was going to go back and forth between Jay and Charlie. It was going to alternate chapters. And I showed it to somebody very early on that said, no, no. This is Jay's book. And I kind of deep down knew it, but I remember going to a hotel room in Palm Springs by myself and sitting on the floor and crying because I knew if I went down that path, what was coming. I knew it was going to hurt. I knew it was going to be a profoundly black book in terms of a colored worldview and that I couldn't hide it. I couldn't dip into you know, Dallas and do the shiny version of Texas in the 80s. It was gonna go there. And it was like in that room that I kind of made a decision. Okay, all right, I'm here. I'll do it. So in that sense, it was very, very cathartic.
And it's a great book.
Well, thank you. From my friend Sydney, by the way. I planted her.
Should we end on that? Oh, I just, yeah, I mean, I think it's cathartic and then it's not, you know, it's like, it's been a year now and I go through periods of really feeling still the consequences of having written this and then feeling free in other moments, but it goes back and forth. And I think, you know, that's just that's my sort of growing pains probably as my relationships take different forms and change. So, you know, it was a hard book to write. It was a hard book to publish. And I've come to peace with feeling proud of it and that it was the right thing. I needed to do it. But there will always be the sort of pain of dealing with other people's stuff still, and not, you know, there's some books and some stories that you will never get permission to tell, and you have to give yourself permission, and that's a scary thing to do, but I had to do it.
Wow.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakchi Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC, 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.